My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the Presidents. I am your host, Joe Fakash, and today we are on the road back to New England in the homes of Calvin Coolidge, 30th President of the United States. We'll be talking about two of the different places that he lives in, Northampton, Massachusetts, and then his ancestral home back in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. Before we go too far, I always want to recommend that you check out the previous season's episode on that individual president, in this case, Calvin Coolidge in Plymouth Notch, season one, episode 30, where we talk about his upbringing in that very small town. We talk about his education, early family life, and then, of course, his personality quirks. Calvin's a rare bird. We'll be talking about that a lot, where he is going to develop certain personality quirks that serve him throughout his entire life and will endear him to some, infuriate others, and provide a really kind of unique presidential profile. One that I think is way better suited for the Gilded Age presidency, but we can get into that in just a little bit. Now, I also want to recommend that you check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to readings, my recommended readings, photographs, other odds and ends. It's a pretty cool resource that I think I'm building, and so you'll want to check that out. Any funds received through the PayPal link on visitingthepresidents.com or in your show notes go to help support future podcast episodes being produced, being hosted, and then with the website hosting as well. I also use those funds to help defray the travel costs and then do research for future episodes. So you can be helping contribute in that way, as well as liking and subscribing in the various social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as getting the word out to your friends and family, whoever you think might be interested, seeing more and more traffic. And so that's really cool when we know that the series is building to something. I want to highlight those who've supported financially. At the top of Mount Rushmore of giving is Sammy and Tom Fakash, Nancy and Terry Wehrkamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakash, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Luck, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Gail Rittenhouse, Stephanie Gaskill, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Matt and Megan Hochstetler, Caitlin Callahan, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Eric Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, and Kristen and Steve Wendell. Thank you all so much, and thank you everybody for helping to build this podcast. Now, where we had left off with Calvin Coolidge, he had just been elected as mayor of Northampton, Massachusetts, the town that we'll be talking about in this episode. In 1912, he would be elected as Massachusetts state senator, where he'll be, believe it or not, known as a progressive, pushing for raising the minimum wage, workmen's compensation, and the state income tax. Calvin was elected state senate president for 2 years, really speaking to how popular he was really on both sides of the aisle, where he will be known for keeping kind of quiet, and people will read into his sphinx-like nature whether or not they agree or disagree with what he's talking about. And so really plays to his benefit and will be what endears him to some and infuriates others. In 1916, Calvin was elected as lieutenant governor, where he would help with appointments and pardons and headed a commission to help bail out an elevated railroad company. In 1918, Calvin was elected as governor of Massachusetts, the only president to serve as governor of Massachusetts, believe it or not. Four other presidents were born in that state, but only Calvin, who's born in a different state, will be their governor. He gets elected in a close election over Richard Long, and he sought to be a kind of voice of reason, pushing for workers' rights as his main issue. His legacy as governor, however, will be defined by his intervention in the Boston policeman strike of 1919, when 75% of the city's policemen walked off the job and a crime wave hit the city. Boston's mayor called for state troops and Coolidge would back him, then ruled that the police force should not be rehired, as might be expected, and said, quote, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone." And this is what will hold him up in really great esteem by later conservatives, especially people like Ronald Reagan, who will famously move the portrait of Calvin Coolidge into his cabinet room. Coolidge's profile increased as many perceived this police action to lead to anarchism, and we were especially sensitive about anarchism in this Red Scare era. We'll turn next to the love of Calvin Coolidge's life, silence. I'm kidding. It's his wife, Grace Coolidge. And while Calvin was always known for being quiet and kind of dour, the exact opposite could be said for his very sunny wife, aptly named Grace. Grace Goodhue was born in 1879 to Andrew and Lamira Goodhue in Burlington, Vermont. Andrew was an engineer. Grace graduated from the University of Vermont and taught at the Clark Institute for the Deaf in Northampton as a lip reading instructor. Grace was at her house watering flowers one day and looked up to see a man shaving in front of a mirror with long underwear and a hat on, and she burst out laughing. Her laughter startled the man, who then came down after dressing to introduce himself, and this is how she met Calvin. They started a long courtship, and it was made longer by her mother not wanting Calvin for Grace. She thought he was too dour and uncommunicative, and that would not be good for her really happy daughter. Calvin and Grace persisted, however, and were married in 1905 when Calvin was 33 and Grace was 26. Grace wanted to be a traditional housewife, taking care of the children, and she would make Calvin's meager public payments stretch. One of the things we'll be talking about as they move into duplex, and that is going to be their home for most of his political career. He wants to show how far the money can go, and he doesn't want to spend on a big house until it becomes a necessity in his post-presidency. He is completely fine living on pretty meager means and just making it stretch, and really believes that conservatism all the way to his way he holds his life. When he gets elevated as vice president, for instance, the Coolidges would move into Thomas Marshall's $8 per week suite at the Willard Hotel with two bedrooms, a kitchen, and living room. They would eat out most nights. And when Calvin was asked why he liked to eat out so much, given how he was pretty awkward and seemed uncomfortable around other people, his reply was, "You have to eat somewhere." Grace helped to, of course, provide a positive front, even though First Lady Florence Harding made no attempt to hide how much she disliked the Coolidges, making sure that they would never be invited to the White House, and even go so far that when Congress was considering building a permanent vice president residence, she will try to talk them out of it, and we won't see one for another 50 years. When Grace becomes First Lady, however, she will not be unkind to Florence and instead will try to adapt to life in the White House. She'll be a popular hostess, throwing a big party, most notably for Charles Lindbergh in his return in 1927. And one of her contributions is going to be really paying attention to the furnishings in the White House. She knows that they're really beautiful rooms and that people like looking at them, and she wants to return them to a kind of colonial style. That will not go over very well when she talks about renovating not just the private rooms where the previous presidents would move in their personal furniture and then take it with them. And in the case of the Coolidges, they don't bring a lot of furniture, so they kind of need to find what's available. And so she tries to locate colonial furnishing, stuff from when James Monroe and Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson were living in the house. And when she starts to locate some of them, she wants some help in terms of securing that funding. And for a time it works, but then they start to turn against that idea. Calvin refused to talk about political issues with Grace, and she will be stunned when she learns that he is not seeking re-election in 1928. When Calvin dies, Grace will be living with him in Northampton, Massachusetts, and lives there for a time, but decides she wants to go back to work, and she'll go back to working with the deaf again. In World War II, she will volunteer to work for the Red Cross. She died in Northampton at a different house in 1957 at the age of 78 and was buried next to Calvin in Plymouth. Now, their lives will be completely rocked when it comes to their own children. Calvin and Grace have two sons. John was in a training camp at Fort Devens when Calvin became president, and he and his brother go to Mercersburg Academy, which you'll remember from the James Buchanan episodes, and then he'll go to Amherst, staying out of the spotlight and rarely visiting the White House. Calvin will be very hard on John for whatever reason, picks on him, makes fun of him, and even assigns one of his Secret Service agents to stalk his son, even living for a time at Amherst with his son just to keep tabs on what his son is doing. And we'll talk about how he becomes really overprotective in the later parts of his presidency, but he will be forever writing the son for not getting up on time, not being up at 5 a.m, not working really hard. And when he finds a letter that his son wrote that he doesn't like his English, he'll say, "How is this your primary language? And I speak it better than you, and I don't have the education you do." Later, John will become a railroad executive and then will try to attach himself more closely to his father's legacy and come around on that kind of difficult or fraught relationship, helping to create the Coolidge Foundation that today runs the State Historic Park and Museum. Now, Calvin Jr. was the apple of Calvin's eye. He often thought that Calvin Jr. looked a lot like his mother, and so some of that has to do with how much he really adored this second boy. Calvin Jr. was also a student at Mercersburg Academy when his father became president, and he comes home to visit the White House over his summer break in 1924. He and his brother are going to play tennis on the South Lawn, and Calvin Jr. in his haste is going to forget to put on socks, or just neglects to put on socks, and he ends up developing a blister on his foot that ends up becoming really, really infected. At first, everybody thinks like, oh, just rest. And Calvin brings in a piano and Grace will play for him to try to soothe him. They bring in a pet rabbit that Calvin holds for Calvin Jr. to try to make his son happy. And his son just keeps getting more and more feverish. Over time, they recognize that he has developed what is known as staphylococcus, an infection that my father had in 1999 and nearly killed him. It was one of the most devastating things in our family, and something that I think we're all very sensitive about now, that my dad was cleaning off our pool cover at the opening of our pool season, and it ended up getting into a cut he had on his hand, and like I said, almost killed him. And today, again, we're so much more careful. You hear all the time about athletes who get staph infections and celebrities, and it's no joke. I remember Rosie O'Donnell on the cover of Newsweek after my dad had a staph infection, and she said, staph is no laugh, and I will attest to that. And in the case of Calvin Jr., it will be devastating. There is nothing they can do to help him. At first, Calvin just cannot accept that his son might actually be dying, that there is nothing he can do to save him, and feels very powerless. And then they come to tell him, your son is near death. He is going to die right now. And so Calvin ran to him. And the stoic Calvin Coolidge, who we always see represented, is going to just completely disappear. And he starts yelling into his son's ear, when you go to heaven, you're going to see my mother, and I need you to tell her, and that he was going to be coming very soon, and just is completely beside himself. And then his son ends up dying. Calvin has a locket from his mother that he's pressing into his son's hand, and his son keeps dropping it, and Calvin will just hold it firm until his son dies. Calvin will forever lose any interest that he has in the presidency, and we'll see how it kind of affects what he does as presidency. There's a pre-death of his son, and there's a post-death, and it will take him a very long time to really kind of come out of it. We've talked about other presidents who have lost their children, including as recently as when we talked about William McKinley and Abraham Lincoln, and of course, Franklin Pierce. And there's something, you know, to me, so very devastating about the idea of having a child and then losing it like that. And to do it while in the White House, you know, that's what's going to make it even more devastating. Since Calvin Coolidge, we've had presidents like, most notably with John F. Kennedy losing his son in 1963, and he will also just kind of lose all control in that moment. And supposedly it brings him and Jackie closer in those final months of his life. You might know that Ronald Reagan and his wife, Jane Wyman, had lost a little daughter in 1948, and this is supposedly an accelerant to their eventual divorce. George H.W. Bush loses his daughter, Robin, and that will be one of those kind of before and after moments in his marriage as well, where that death will be so devastating and a really formative experience in George W.'s life. And then, of course, with our current president, Joe Biden, to have lost one of his daughters and his wife in a very tragic car accident. And he speaks all the time about how that really shapes his life and shapes his kind of empathy and understanding of other people. With Calvin, he will be much in line with when we talked about Mary Todd Lincoln or Jane Pierce or Ida McKinley, where they will lose a child and really kind of never recover. And in those cases, it was the president who would bring them back and try to help them out of their grief, or at least try to help them move forward. And in this case, it's going to be Grace who really serves that function. Now, publicly, Calvin is going to remain super stoic. And when he is seen by his son's graveside in Vermont, he will not be shedding tears. He will not be having these public demonstrations. The only way you would know anything had happened is he would wear that black mourning band around his arm. For the White House staff, this will also be super devastating. Keep in mind that they had just dealt with now four different presidencies that have been touched by a sudden health episode, with Helen Taft having her stroke, both Ellen Wilson dying in the White House, and then her husband Woodrow having that debilitating stroke in the White House, and then of course President Harding dying, even if it was away from the White House. We think he might have been experiencing health complications before. And Florence herself struggling with her health. In this case, Calvin is going to be mourning his son, and it will really get in the way of his ability to carry out the duties of the office. He will take to napping an extraordinary amount after the death of his son. And I remember growing up reading about how he liked to sleep a lot and just thinking like, oh, that's in line with this like quirky weirdo from Vermont who just, you know, midday will take his leave and, you know, take a really long nap. And then over time, when you recognize, like, that's a symptom of depression, and that idea of going through the different stages of grief, I think this is one that he really never truly emerges from. He'll famously say the power and glory of the presidency went with him. And he'll remark several times, I don't understand why this was the price I had to pay in order to be president. And so, like I said, he never truly emerges from this. He never truly gets over it. Now, back to Chicago in 1920, Calvin was the favorite son for the state of Massachusetts, but he faded from consideration early on. When the nomination for vice presidential candidates comes up, however, Coolidge quickly becomes the front runner, and he will win on the first ballot. Calvin will campaign moderately, more than Harding, but anybody could be campaigning more than Warren Harding. And then when they get elected as vice president, Calvin will attend cabinet meetings, but rarely participates. And I know that'll come as a great shock to you. And he'll never interject when he's in the Senate either. Coolidge was pretty disengaged from any of the scandals that were starting to envelop the Harding presidency. And that will help him to be pretty exacting when it comes to how to discipline it, how to move on from what had gone on in the Harding White House. Calvin was vacationing at his father's home in Plymouth Notch, Vermont on August the 2nd, 1923, when President Harding will die. The Coolidge farm did not have a telephone, so three men from nearby Bridgewater went in the middle of the night to the Coolidge home, woke up Calvin's father, John, who then informed the vice president that he had now been elevated to that top role. Calvin and Grace were stunned, and they knelt to say a prayer with John and then went downstairs to take the oath of office by lamplight, with John as a justice of the peace for that town, inaugurating his son. The only time we've ever seen that kind of thing happen. Now, you'll be very shocked to learn that Calvin, upon becoming president, decides, what does he need next? Go back to sleep. And so that's what he'll do. Now, his presidency will quickly move to provide that normalcy that Warren Harding had promised, moving quickly to clean house and get to the bottom of the Teapot Dome scandal. The Revenue Acts of 1924 and 1926 will reduce income tax and seemed mainly to focus on the wealthy, leading to a round of speculation that would have disastrous effects at the end of the decade. The Immigration Act of 1924 reduced the quotas for foreign-born immigrants to be allowed into the country, going from 3% to 2%, and basing those numbers for each country on 1890 as opposed to 1910 in the earlier legislation, which will have the effect of limiting the number of immigrants from so-called less desirable Southern and Eastern European countries, as well as Jews. After 1927, 150,000 immigrants would be allowed in each year, and the Japanese would be excluded entirely. Coolidge will approve of what's called the Air Commerce Act, which provided for transcontinental airway routes and supported the expansion of air travel. Calvin will veto veteran bonus legislation and farm relief bills as overreach of the government and the executive's powers. Famously, Coolidge's Secretary of State, Frank Kellogg, will help draw up the Kellogg-Briand Pact, where 15 member countries, including the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and Japan, will agree to renounce war as a means of settling disputes between nations. And I always show my students this image of them signing the Kellogg-Briand Pact with giant gold pen and saying, and after that, we never had war again. And they just look at me in stunned silence. And it's like, yeah, that's about all that legislation really did. Of course, the 1920s today are represented through this huge surge of consumerism. And so there is the inherent debt issue that we can start to chart from this moment forward. And beneath all of the fun flapper era and jazz music, the way we always interpret the 1920s and movies and television with the Great Gatsby parties and the like, there's also this undercurrent of nativism that's on the rise that sees the second surge of the Ku Klux Klan taking political hold in many areas of the country, not just the Deep South, the way we like to tell ourselves. This huge surge in lynchings and the fallout of a lot of race hatred and rise in fundamentalism that really makes for a dark undercurrent as juxtaposed against what is seen as some economic security. And that's leaving alone what's happening in other parts of the world as we're starting to see a turn towards fascism in places like Italy and eventually Germany. I always tell my students, this iteration of the Ku Klux Klan were equal opportunity offenders. They hated everybody that wasn't white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, right? They were going after immigrants. They were going after Catholics as well as Jews. They were going after Mexicans as as well as African Americans. And this is the group that you're really familiar with, where they have the giant crosses and the hoods. But they also were savvily finding themselves in places of prominence in a lot of communities across the country and positioning themselves as a civic organization and along the lines of an American Legion or Veterans of Foreign Wars, where they would have these parades and festivals and try to position themselves as a family-friendly event and have whole arms of their national apparatus that were dedicated to winning over women as well as children to this really hateful group. And that's the insidious nature of the Klan in this iteration, and to my mind, emblematic of some of the turn towards nativism that we see.
Calvin will stand for re-election following Theodore Roosevelt as just the second vice president to be nominated for his own term at the convention held in Cleveland in 1924. There had been some talk of replacing him, you know, that he had been elevated to this role, but would he really be an effective president? But so popular was he early on that nobody really had anything to say negatively against him. And he seemed to be doing the job and divorced enough from what had gone on in the Harding White House. And so far, he was having a good time in the presidency. As I said before, he's a bit of a throwback to the Gilded Age presidents, where he'll largely defer to Congress. And so if I'm a Republican in the House or Senate, you kind of like what Calvin is providing, where he is staying completely out of things. And he'll also defer largely to his very able cabinet. Remember when we talked about Charles Evans Hughes and Andrew Mellon and Herbert Hoover running the show, and he'll say, like, I don't know anything on those topics, so of course I'll defer to those men. And so they kind of like it too. This is that process, what we call associationalism, where the government just stays out of the personal lives and any public intrusion. And for the most part, that will work. Now, as we talked about, where this has effect on what goes on at the end of the decade, where we start to see our economy start to tank. Well, this is the other side of that, where for a while, everything seems to go well. But when things get a little bit hairy, we don't have that relationship between the government intervening. And that's going to be the real problem. Now, here in 1924, Coolidge will be nominated on the first ballot, and they will choose Charles Dawes of Illinois to be his running mate. Dawes had served as the budget director under Warren Harding. Coolidge's opponent for the general election will be John W. Davis from West Virginia. Davis had served as Solicitor General and President Wilson's ambassador to the Court of St. James, or the ambassador to Great Britain. Davis had emerged from a protracted Democratic convention where the delegates famously rejected a platform plank that condemned the Ku Klux Klan and left the party in complete disarray. This was the subject of my dissertation called A Party in Peril: Franklin Roosevelt, the Democratic Party, and the Circular Letter of 1924, where everything kind of runs amok. It takes 103 ballots to get to John W. Davis. As I said, they will reject a plank to condemn what the Ku Klux Klan is doing. And afterwards, a lot of Democrats feel just completely devastated. And when we look at the general election results, this will provide a moment for them to really kind of come back and take stock of what has gone down. And Franklin Roosevelt will really lead the way. I'll link to my dissertation if you're so inclined. I'm kind of proud of it and think it's still a pretty good work on that topic. And maybe you'll find it fascinating as well as we come on the 100th anniversary of this really kind of pivotal moment for the Democratic Party. Robert La Follette, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, added to the disorder by running a third party bid with the Progressive Party. Coolidge's backers will run with the slogan of "Keep cool with Coolidge," and were successful at distancing themselves from the scandals of President Harding. Coolidge will win 54% to just 29% for John W. Davis and 17% for Robert La Follette, the worst showing for a major party candidate other than Taft in 1912. This was really the high moment for Calvin Coolidge being renominated, and then a month later he will lose his son. And after that, everything kind of washes away. Now, we talked about many of the kind of legislative triumphs and everything else that we could talk about in that second term, his first and only full term. Calvin is largely in absentia. He's letting the Congress really kind of dictate things, and his cabinet officials really kind of set the standards in individual departments. Calvin will be MIA for many of the major decisions, going from working around the clock and staying on Sundays to work to suddenly taking these 4-hour long naps and then retiring pretty early in the evening and really not providing too much leadership in that role. And so that will be where his legacy is really set. Now, again, some people really kind of like this. I'm going to read to you from H.L. Mencken's kind of obituary for Calvin Coolidge after he passes away. in what manner he would have performed himself if the holy angels had shoved the depression forward a couple of years. This we can only guess. One man's hazard is as good as another. My own guess is that he would have responded to bad times precisely as he responded to good ones. That is, by pulling down the blinds, stretching his legs upon the desk, and snoozing away his lazy afternoons. He slept more than any other president, whether by day or by night. Nero fiddled, but Coolidge only snored. Counting out Harding as a cipher only, Coolidge was preceded by one world saver, meaning Wilson, and followed by two more, Hoover and Roosevelt. What enlightened American, having to choose between any of them and another Coolidge, would hesitate for an instant? There were no thrills while he reigned, but neither were there any headaches. He had no ideas, and he was not a nuisance. And you can imagine, in many ways, that he is the fulfillment of what Harding had promised. You know, I will stay out of your business. We're going to get back to your life before Roosevelt and Wilson shook things up. We'll get you back to life where you get to dictate your own terms. That is all well and good, like I said, when the economy is going well. But towards the end of his administration, when things are starting to teeter and some of the economic warning signs were showing, that is where that laissez-faire attitude is really going to come back and haunt the Republican Party. And it will be his successor, Herbert Hoover, who Coolidge is very kind of cool to, that he will be the one who really kind of absorbs what comes next. Now, with Calvin, as I talked about in season one, there are all sorts of stories about his famous wit and his humor and the fact that he famously will say, "You lose," when a woman says, "I can get you to say more than two words," as a bet. And so much of what he does is going to be seen as quirky. He seems to like having fun with his persona. There's a famous image of him wearing a native headdress. He doesn't mind wearing costumes or looking ridiculous, because he said at one point, like, if it makes other people laugh, if they're laughing and they're having fun, like, why is that a bad thing? Like, why wouldn't I want that? And so it's kind of interesting to think of him as somebody who was willing to kind of make fun of himself, or at least has fun at his own expense. And so it isn't all horrible stuff with Calvin Coolidge. But again, I do want us to be cognizant of the fact that there is that kind of push-pull that comes with Calvin Coolidge, that on the one hand, things will be running pretty smoothly and he will get all of the benefits of that. And then afterwards, we'll see where things get a little hairy and he's not there. Now, when it comes to the Coolidges in the White House, I told you a little bit about where Grace is trying to redecorate the upper floor of the White House with more appropriate, period appropriate furniture. But when she turns her attention to the lower levels, and in particular, when people hear that she's going after the green room and the red room, they weren't the way that they look now. I have to be clear. They did look pretty haphazard. And we'd seen where every time that we would get pushed to kind of redecorate these rooms, they would do a really good job, but then the taste would change over time. And so she's just trying to adapt to that, and people go hog wild. Now, what then is going to be the big game changer is the recognition that the White House was kind of trying to cave in on itself. Calvin will famously say, "I think the only reason it's still standing is out of habit," where they had taken the original structure, remember, that had been built in the 1790s and then gets completely gutted in 1814. After that rebuild, they start to reinforce parts of it, but other parts they're just topping with new equipment and new items. And when they build an attic, they're going to apply steel bracings on top of what had been these wooden trusses. And so you're having parts of it that are joined together that have really no business being on top of one another. And then to add insult to injury, we're starting to see where the old attic had been a really kind of sloped roof style. And so none of those rooms were really able to be used and were mainly used by servants who at one point lived in the White House. Well, now that we're not seeing those servants still living in the White House, they wanted to have space for if you had a larger family, if you had future guests that would come, you know, that would give you enough space. And it will pay off handsomely when we get to talking about, for instance, World War II, and the White House is inundated with foreign dignitaries who are fleeing really hairy situations abroad. Now, to add to the attic, they're going to have to take off the ceilings of the second floor, so where the president sleeps, the Lincoln bedroom, the yellow oval room, all of those really kind of beautiful rooms on the second floor. They also are going to be touched by this damage. At first, Calvin thinks, you know, I'll deal with it. You guys can, you know, tear up the ceiling and we'll just stay in there. And they finally tell him, like, no, we're going to need you to leave for a few months. It is only going to take a few months. And they're able to restore it. Now, when they do add on, they're going to give them a whole separate floor for that third level, and they will add different bedrooms. We'll talk about some of these later, but one of them will be the famous music room that today has a kind of second level, and then the famous solarium that was going to be the big innovation that Grace Coolidge was super fond of, this kind of sunroom on the upper level of the White House that other first families have really adored, where they're able to get some of that sunlight, able to get some fresh air without the prying eyes that would happen if you try to open a window on the lower levels. Spoiler alert, you can't, but this is going to be a room that you can kind of hide away and have a promenade around that attic area so that you can walk around and be disguised. Now, this will also cause architectural damage. This is going to be something that will lead 20 years later to the piano caving in on poor Margaret Truman and lead to them having to completely gut the White House in the late 1940s, early 1950s. But this is going to at least add to that idea that there should be a supporting floor, as reading in William Seale's book on the President's House, where he talks about how the lower level, the very lowest level, the basement with the kitchen, the library, is all in service to the state level floor, the red room, blue room, east room, dining room. And then for the family's level, the second floor, they need their own floor to be in service of them as well. And so that's where this now has a linen room. They have all sorts of different storage areas. They have their own kitchen and dining room, that kind of thing. And so it was really interesting to read up on how that floor has been used in recent presidencies. And so on the third level, this is going to be where we see, in some cases, other dignitaries will stay when they have very large groups that come with them. But Michelle Obama's mother, when she was staying in the White House to live with the daughters and kind of watch over them, she has her own suite on the third level, and that will give her her own privacy, and she can come and go without disturbing the four Obamas. And then apparently Barron Trump had his own suite on that third level as well, and probably for the same reasons. He could be kind of away from Donald and Melania and have, you know, a semblance of what a child might want in the White House. And so that's how the third floor can be somewhat used today. You might know that this is also where they have a music room that Hillary Clinton had converted for Bill Clinton, where he could play his saxophone to his heart's content. They have a workout space that George W. Bush is famous for really kind of trying to implement there. Apparently, Hillary also had a room filled with Eleanor Roosevelt memorabilia. And so you can use it for those kinds of purposes. And we don't have so many images of those upper level rooms. And the ones that I have seen, they're kind of ordinary. They aren't anything too very special. Those bedrooms that you're thinking of, the Lincoln bedroom, the Queen's bedroom, are all on that middle level, the second level with the president's bedroom. But all of the really kind of more ordinary ones are going to be a floor above. And that we have to thank the Coolidges for. In terms of getting away from the White House, Calvin and his family do go on one really major trip when it comes to going to South Dakota. And I always thought of him just as like driving through South Dakota when he famously announces he will not run for presidency in 1928. So they're there in the summer of 1927, and they're there for, I've read, somewhere between 7 weeks and 3 months, and kind of just decamp to South Dakota. Stay in a pretty nice place, but still are away from the White House for a considerable amount of time. And that's where he famously will issue this one sentence declaration: I do not choose to run for president. And that will set everything alight in terms of then having to think about a replacement. The Coolidges also had a pet raccoon named Rebecca, who they like to entertain by putting it in the bathtub with a bar of soap. And I just think that's so awful. I've never gotten behind that idea. But I do think Grace has one of our best First Lady portraits, a famous image of her with her collie on the south lawn of the White House. Now let's turn our attention to the Coolidges' homes, and we'll start first in Northampton. At first, they lived in a two-family house, a duplex, on what was called Massasoit Street. The home had 7 rooms and was comfortable, and the Coolidges will live there from 1906 through when they leave for Washington, and even try to come back there. From Lost New England, a site that I linked to on the website, Calvin had written at one point, "We liked the house where our children came to us and the neighbors who were so kind. When we could have had a more pretentious home, we still clung to it. So long as I lived there, I could be independent and serve the public without ever thinking that I could not maintain my position if I lost my office. I always made my living practicing law up to the time I became governor without being dependent on any official salary. This left me free to make my own decisions in accordance with what I thought was the public good. We lived where we did that I might better serve the people. Now, like I said, this will become a huge problem during his retirement as he tries to go back to living there. And anytime they want to go sit out on their front steps, people are going to be coming by and drawing a crowd, trying to just watch this president in the midst. And so this is something we'll see Harry Truman dealing with when he leaves the White House as well. A neighbor had estimated that an automobile will pass by every 6 seconds and that they will block the streets, with people driving by pretty slowly just to try to catch a glimpse of poor Calvin Coolidge, who's just trying to live out his life, live out his later years. So once they recognize that there's not enough privacy there, the Coolidges will move to a larger home that was called The Beeches. I'm going to read to you from the New York Times on when the Coolidges had purchased this home. The New York Times said that he had moved from a tenement house to their new 16-room English country house, one of the most beautiful estates in Northampton. And it was so named because of 80 beech trees along the property. Grounds include a brook well stocked with trout, a private swimming pool, tennis courts screened in with trellises 10 feet high on all sides with climbing roses, a large vegetable and truck garden with a big asparagus bed and a berry patch, a beautiful rose garden, and many winding walks. The whole place is screened from the public view by trees and will give Mr. and Mrs. Coolidge the privacy they enjoy so thoroughly. On the ground floor of the home are a reception room, dining room, a library with a capacity of 5,000 books, a living room and a drawing room, a servant's dining room and culinary department, and a large sun porch, which sweeps across the front end of the house and offers an unhampered view of Mount Tom, Mount Holyoke, and miles of the beautiful Connecticut River. There are two suites on the second floor, each provided with private baths. Fireplaces of brick and cane stone are located in two of the bedchambers and in the living rooms and library on the first floor. Each sleeping suite has a sleeping porch. On the third floor are a billiard room, two guest rooms, and two maid's rooms. Sounds like pretty nice digs to me. Now, of course, the other place that Calvin will stay kind of famously is going to be his family's home in Plymouth. And when I talked in last season's episode, we talked about his birthplace at the back of the general store. And right across the street from that is going to be the home that he then moves into when his father remarries. And so that is a home that he's going to stay at quite a bit and is actually there that week when he becomes president. Today, you can go into that home as well and get to see all of the different furnishings. Famously, like we said, no telephone, also no indoor bathrooms. And so our president, in as recently as 100 years ago, was still using an outdoor bathroom the day he became a president. Now, when it comes to you visiting these places, that ancestral home is really the only one that you're able to visit. The duplex is privately owned. They do have a marker on the porch that shows that it was the home of Calvin Coolidge at one point. And that is the only thing. I'm not even sure inside if there's anything that is resembling what it would have been like when Calvin and his family lived there. And keep in mind, he's always back and forth between Boston or Washington. And so in terms of them having too many furnishings, they really, really didn't and don't. In terms of the Beeches is privately owned, has been privately owned. Grace had stayed in the home for a period of time after Calvin's death, but she finds a different residence. They do register both in the National Register of Historic Places. And Northampton is so proud of Calvin that they will dedicate a part of their library called the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Library. It's like two rooms, but does have some of his memorabilia. For the Beeches, they do have a marker on the fence that notes that it was the home of Calvin Coolidge, but it is privately owned. When I went to go try to track it down, I was on my way from Hyde Park heading to Concord, New Hampshire to see Franklin Pierce's home. And the route took me through Northampton. I thought, well, when am I ever going to have a better opportunity than to try to track down the Beeches? I didn't try to look for the duplex. I also didn't do the library. So I do have to go back to Northampton. But the Beeches, you go to this very kind of isolated street. There's a sign that shows which way to the Beeches, but it also notes that it is private property. So I didn't drive down there, parked my car, walked down. I just wanted to take a picture from the exterior on the street. And so got a couple photos, got a photo of myself, my requisite selfie, and then got back in my car and on my way. I saw family that was like putting stuff in their car, and so I didn't want to disturb them. That is not what I'm about. And so just went on my way and would love to get to see it at some point. Now, of course, I cannot be more fond of Plymouth and of Vermont in general, and getting to go inside that house is really cool. Now, the thing that they have done is they have added on to the back area and then torn out what had been the existing wall. So what you're walking through wouldn't have been there when Calvin lives there. they're going to be added on so that it can allow for people to come through without being able to touch anything. So the family rooms are all kind of glassed off and have signs that say what is where, and you can see the room where Calvin took the oath of office. What's really cool about this place is where they bring you in is going to be their like old barn. And the way that the New Englanders had done it is each barn would connect to another barn or shed. And so you're kept in from the hot or cold and just going through these progressive areas, but then they would have all served a separate purpose. The bedroom that Calvin was staying in is on the second level, and so they brought down a lot of the furnishings on the main level so that you can see it without having to go up the stairs. And so the way they have it presented is really, you get a really good idea of how the Coolidges would have lived, but you're not disturbing anything. What it tells us about the president with Calvin, you know, there really is no other way to say that he is somebody who is pretty frugal. Others might say cheap. And so the duplex, no surprise that that would be on in private hands. And the ancestral homeless homestead is going to be as furnished as possible, but you get a real sense for how rustic this must have been. And I always think, if you're Grace, like, you really have to love Calvin to go back to that house and be like, okay, so I'm gonna have to give up indoor plumbing, which has been a modern convenience now for people of their stature for decades, and they're going to rough it. And you might see these images of Calvin when he would go back to his father's farm, and he would be working out in the fields. He gets really mad at one point, that they always make a point of it in the museum, where he is videoed wearing this really long, almost like a nightgown, and out in the field. And it's what he would have worn when he was growing up, but people were accusing him of putting it on and kind of dressing the part, you know, trying to make things look more rustic than they were. And so he gets very sensitive to that. But when he was there, he was, you know, back to being a farm boy and helping out with the chores and stuff. And it's just such an interesting kind of dynamic. I think I am touched by the fact that Calvin was so struck by his son's death and what that meant. And it does kind of give you that distance maybe with any of the homes that he touches after that death, where, you know, you don't really get the sense of him getting personal pleasure out of it. At that point, it must have just seemed like, when am I on to the next thing? His death, which we'll talk about in season 3, was really sudden. And everybody remarked about how, like, they thought he had so much longer to live, a real post-presidency to go through. But it really seems to me he was on the way out almost as soon as his son died, and was all too eager to kind of join him. And so you really do get a sense of that when you think about the time that they would be at the beaches. Any other president, any normal person would love a home like that. And instead, it's just a reminder of the grief that he and his family go through. In the case of the Calvin Coolidge State Historic Park in Plymouth, again, I cannot recommend that site enough. It is just so cool. I think maybe some of it is that when I was growing up, my parents would take us to, we had in Northwest Ohio, Auglaize Village, which was this kind of recreated old time area along the Auglaize River in Defiance County. And then we would go to Sauter Village in Archbold, Ohio. Shout out Northwest Ohio on these two. You could go to Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan, and get a real sense for how we preserve these old places, and, you know, what it's like to go to an old barber shop, and what do you do when you go to the print shop, and how do they blow glass, and all those kinds of things. And I loved it. I could not have been happier. And I recognize now that that's not what everybody gets when they go to these places, but I loved it. And to me, going to Plymouth is a bit like that, where you get a good sense of this town frozen in amber. You could almost believe that Calvin just walked into his dad's house to take a nap and that he'll get up any second. And I love that. I just love that part of going to Plymouth. And so I definitely recommend you checking that out. And if you're in Northampton, check out the 3 different sites, but be mindful that the 2 are privately owned. And I think Calvin would want it that way, right? Not to stand on ceremony and have it dedicated to himself, but rather to be incorporated and enjoyed by another family. And so I could see where he would get a real kick out of that. So then we will turn our attention next to Herbert Clark Hoover. His will be very interesting in that he has a couple different homes. He is a real nomad for most of his early years. And then towards the end of his life, we'll be living in one of the nicest presidential places that you and I will never get to visit. That's the Waldorf Astoria, but we'll be talking about that in next episode, so you won't want to miss that. Remember to check out Visiting the Presidents, where you can find links to other readings, my recommended readings, episodes, and other odds and ends that I put up on the different sites. You can also find a link to help support the podcast through donating. Always very well appreciated, and will help to support the future of this podcast and the website. My recommended readings for Calvin Coolidge are are Amity Schlesz, Coolidge, very good book. The Autobiography of Calvin Coolidge, that is written by Calvin himself. And then Presidency of Calvin Coolidge by Robert Farrell. That's probably my favorite, but then I also love the Schlesz book. All season, I've been bringing you content from Away from the White House, Homes of the Presidents, Houses of the Presidents, as well as First Dads by Joshua Kendall, The Complete Book of U.S. Presidents by William D. Gregorio, and then The President's Home by William Seal. As always, I look forward to seeing you out there on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.